This is Andrew Peach with World Business Report here on the BBC World Service. On the way, why Wall Street is celebrating one of its own getting the top job at the US Treasury.
People are over the moon about the reasonable, non-ideological choice of a very rational player like Scott Bessent, who is not a TV personality. He's a person of serious substance.
Rising energy costs and increased competition lead to thousands of job losses in German steel production.
The miracle of capitalism that it brings the resources to where they are most productive. The question is, can we organize this process in a smooth way that doesn't produce the social issues that we have seen in past transitions?
And the eye-watering sum spent on cricketers in the Indian Premier League auction. We'd love to hear from you on today's stories. Do drop us a message or a voice note. WhatsApp +44 330 678 3033 or email world.business@bbc.co.uk. First, the markets have been reacting to Donald Trump's nomination of Scott Bessent as Treasury Secretary. Stocks are up. The dollar has weakened. To find out why, I spoke to our business correspondent in New York, Michelle Fleury.
So this is the market signalling that they love Donald Trump's appointment of Scott Bessent. This is the hedge fund manager who's been picked for the top economic job in the cabinet. And it's a big role because it will help shape the incoming president's economic agenda, which we know includes immigration, tax cuts, tariffs. Crucially for the market, he's also said he cares about the deficit. And this is something that investors have been increasingly concerned about. It was something that neither candidate, quite frankly, talked about on the campaign trail. Scott Bessent has said that, you know, he wants to be tough on deficit. And he's come up with this idea of this 3-3-3, so 3% reduction in the deficit, 3% growth in the US economy that he wants to see over the next couple of years, and also 3% increase in energy production. And I guess, you know, what we're seeing right now is markets like that. So the Dow is up at a record close. You've got the dollar down in part because they think this will be less inflation. You've got bond yields also falling sharply because they think this will be less inflationary. There'll be less debt. And so that's why you're seeing these moves.
So the market's basically marking Donald Trump's homework here and saying you picked a grown up.
Scott Bessent was the front runner from the very beginning. He was very loyal, very aligned to Donald Trump. He had made campaign appearances on the trail with him. He was also a big donor. But there were some within Trump world who felt that he was not tough enough on issues like tariffs. And there had been some jockeying or infighting going on. And it seems that ultimately, Trump was torn between kind of the different voices within, you know, his group of advisors pulling him in different directions. But he always kept a strong eye on sort of what the markets were worried about, the kind of markets which often he uses as a scorecard. And so in picking Scott Bessent, he's essentially gone with what Elon Musk called as the business as usual choice. He meant that as something of an insult, but the markets, that is exactly what they wanted.
Let's hear a bit of Scott Bessent in his own words now. In an interview with Fox News, he was asked what he'd tell Donald Trump to do as president.
Everyone asks me, what do you tell President Trump he should do? I don't have to tell Donald Trump he should do anything. He's done it. We had a great economy under Trump 1.0. 2016 to just till we hit the wall in COVID was one of the greatest periods in American history. I think under Donald Trump, we could have a golden age for the next 4 years.
Well, Jeffrey Sonnenfeld is professor at Yale School of Management. He used to teach alongside Scott Bessent, and tell me why the markets have reacted so positively to his nomination.
There were signals it might come out this way when Howard Lutnick didn't get the job despite the self-anointed co-president Elon Musk pushing differently. Musk was, as you know, very much pushing towards Howard Lutnick of Cantor Fitzgerald. And it was a big snow shovel in the face of Elon Musk that he didn't get that candidate through, just like he didn't get Matt Gaetz in as attorney general. That this is certainly suggesting that Trump is showing some independence and not yielding to his self-anointed co-president to make these decisions. That was pretty encouraging. People are over the moon about the reasonable, non-ideological choice of a very rational player like Scott Bessent, who is no grandiosity about him. He's not a TV personality. He's a person of serious substance, and he's developed a tremendous expertise, a wonderful reputation for decision-making, problem-solving, and for some prescient calls.
And he's a Wall Street guy, right? And Trump really cares about the markets doing well while he's president. It's one of the barometers that really bothers him.
He is a Wall Street guy. He is, unlike many in the MAGA movement, he's not xenophobic. He appreciates the value of immigrants in the workforce, whether or not highly skilled labor or in other kinds of positions that we don't have enough workers to fill. He is not an isolationist. He understands the importance of a global diplomacy and interdependence in the world. And he also is not protectionist and believes that we're part of a global economy. That is hugely reassuring. And he believes in the rule of law, not the law of rulers. And that's awfully important to business leaders. And when it comes to issues that are trigger points, such as tariffs all the time on all products in all countries, where it's ranged from 10 to 20%, unless you're a Chinese producer. And now we're hearing the talk of 60%. Scott Bessent puts that in the category of more threat than reality, more bark than bite, that he sees that as a threatening cudgel to use to negotiate better rates. Even with the EU, our allies, it costs 2% tariff on every car imported into the US from the EU, but it's 10% for us to get our cars into the EU. So there's some justification and things like that before we get to China. But when we get to China, there will be some stiff ones on weapons grade chips and on where there's dumping, especially in metals.
Very interesting to hear you talk about him using tariffs as a bargaining tool rather than actually necessarily wanting to introduce them. And the other thing I'm really getting is that Scott Bessent is an affable guy. He's more diplomat than disruptor.
That's exactly right, Andrew. And since you've given me the time to develop it, he looks at the tariffs differently than people like President Trump have spoken about them in the MAGA movement. When he was here, he was teaching about the boom or bust history of the financial cycles. He's very much aware of the destructive impact of the 1930 Smoot-Hawley tariffs and how it exacerbated the Great Depression. He's not looking to do something reckless like that. So across the board, his erudition matches his experience in terms of wise decision-making, as opposed to being driven by bravado and ideology. But he's able to fight. That he was able to go into this knife fight for this position with the voluble and bellicose Elon Musk and Howard Lutnick going up against him. He still got the job that he should have gotten.
One of the things that I suspect has propelled Donald Trump to the White House is people's concern about inflation, even if it's coming down when you look at the numbers. Tariffs are inflationary. Reducing the supply of migrant labor is inflationary. Is Scott Bessent going to be able to keep inflation low with those policies coming out of his boss in the White House?
It's going to be very hard. Right now, inflation is down. Almost all commodities is down. Inflation has been largely conquered. However, if we wind up with huge tariffs, which Bessent's going to try to moderate, if that gets past Bessent, and we wind up with what most economists say could add 15% increase in inflation, it'd be terrible. But the wage growth right now is well ahead of inflation. Wage growth is, average wage growth is about 4.5%. It's taken a long time, and this is only in the last, not even the full last year, that finally wages are way ahead of inflation. But if they take the wrong paths on immigration by getting rid of workers that are so badly needed, with a 4% unemployment, there's no immigrant that's displacing a native-born American. That's nonsense. It was just Trumpaganda used to create fear in the country. And same with tariffs. They better not go overboard on that, or then we wind up destroying the best economy this nation's ever had that was handed to them.
That was Jeffrey Sonnenfeld from the Yale School of Management. Live now to Peter Yankauskas, Vice President of Research and Analysis at Arbor Financial Services in Chicago. Peter, thank you for being with us. Are the gains we've seen on the markets today sustainable?
I think so. I think there is a possibility. Certainly the new Treasury pick does have some battles to fight to limit tariffs and rein in spending, if you will. But I also think there's one thing that hasn't been mentioned, and that is he's a believer in deregulation, which I think is also a powerful force that could help keep the U.S. economy going.
Are there concerns about the weaker dollar? I know that's because concerns about inflation have sort of abated a little bit with this appointment, but are we worried about the dollar being down?
I don't think so. It'll take a while to see what sort of a trend develops. The dollar has shown considerable strength over the last few years, so some moderation there is I think welcome, given that it propped up and became so strong immediately after the election.
Peter, stay with us. Now to Germany, where the economy has been going through tough times in recent months. Many economists say it's become too dependent on cheap Russian gas. The BBC has been talking to the former German Chancellor, Angela Merkel. She was an advocate of the Nord Stream 2 gas pipeline to increase imports of gas from Russia. And she says she doesn't regret her efforts to forge closer ties there.
I was motivated by two things. Firstly, Germany's economic interest. Secondly, I believe that, despite all the difficulties, we should do everything we can to establish a relationship with Russia that would enable us to coexist peacefully. I did try to curb the attacks in Ukraine through the Minsk agreements. That worked to an extent for a few years, though not brilliantly.
The German steelmaker ThyssenKrupp has announced it's shedding 11,000 workers. Since Russia invaded Ukraine, the cost of gas in Germany has risen sharply, especially after Nord Stream 2 was destroyed by an explosion. I've been talking to Georg Zachmann, who used to work at the Federal Ministry of Finance in Berlin, is now senior fellow at Bruegel, and I asked if the high cost of gas was behind the company's move.
The answer is, as always, rather complex. There are company-level things, and here you have to see that the company is highly unionized, and seemingly they are also seeking the moment to do some restructuring that they anyway wanted to do, kind of blaming it to the general economic trends. But at the same time, we also have on the European steel industry a couple of challenges: increasing Chinese exports, global market wobbles with higher tariffs being announced, and so more steel being redirected to Europe. And of course, the questions around Europe's decarbonization, what it means for steel production cost in Europe and the energy cost.
Let's just unpick some of those things on your list. There's obviously something that links this story with 11,000 jobs going today with car manufacturers Volkswagen and Ford losing loads of jobs in Europe last week, and specifically lots of jobs being lost in Germany, where the unions are strong and companies are in a battle with them.
So one of the issues that is often quoted and pointed to is German energy prices. And on that, I think the answer is it's quite complex. On the one hand, we have indeed seen higher energy prices than before the energy crisis, and we will certainly not have the low energy prices that the United States is going to be able to offer with their own endowment in unconventional gas, for example. But at the same time, that were things that that also were already there before. So the are seemingly deeper structural issues in Germany, and one is a lack of investment. One is a misinvestment also in regions and in technologies that were maybe not fit for the 21st century.
Could you sort of lump yes. those things together under the heading productivity, that somehow European firms are lagging behind other parts of the world?
The bigger question is, how do we make most efficient use of the resources that we have? And we know that energy is relatively expensive, so we shouldn't do very energy intensive stuff in regions where energy is not that much available. There's a very important debate to be had in Europe at the moment about, should some energy intensive sectors move to regions where energy is cheaper, for example, the coastlines where we have wind, or the sunny areas of Europe. So that is a huge transitional challenge. And the other transitional challenge that is ahead of us is in terms of technologies. So the incumbents like Volkswagen found it extremely difficult to switch away from the cash cows, so the huge comparative advantage they had in internal combustion engines and the massive margins they were able to make to essentially the new technologies such as electric vehicles. And that opened the space for newcomers like Tesla and China to come in. So
interesting, the idea of moving heavy industry to the coast to be near sources of renewable energy. Do you think the energy prices is going to be an ephemeral thing, though? I mean, they've been pushed up by the war in Ukraine, which is not going to go on forever. In fact, if you listen to Donald Trump, it may not go on much longer at all.
We will in any way have to decarbonize our energy sector, which means we will have to let go on coal and natural gas. So that option of getting cheap Russian gas to outcompete the US on their LNG is probably not available for any long period of time. So I think that that is over. And gas is also probably not going to be the cheapest fuel in the medium term. So I think low-cost electricity is the name of the game. If we want to decarbonize our economy, that's where we need to go. And that means that places that had access to gas pipelines, places that had access to coal mines in the past, are those areas where a lot of the energy-intensive industry is concentrated, but it might not be those areas where the energy-intensive industry of the future should be.
And Georg, you've talked about some of the headwinds that companies like ThyssenKrupp are facing, and also some of the mistakes perhaps that big European firms have made up until this point. Is this, therefore, the loss of thousands of jobs just some kind of correction that needs to happen at this point?
If you just look at individual companies closing down parts of the business and these workers being employed in other sectors that are more productive and are more in line with the future needs, then it would actually be a good transition because, yes, at some moment we lost all the workers in the coal mines and then they moved to other places and we are more productive there. And now maybe some of the old coal-based steel plants will have to live through the same fate.
Georg Zachmann with me. Back to Peter Jankowskis now in Chicago. Macy's will be busy in the run-up to Thanksgiving on Thursday, no doubt, but they've lost a huge amount of money in their mail order business.
Yes, they have. They uncovered an employee that apparently had been falsifying records and about somewhere between $130 and $150 million has been misplaced over the last 3 years.
Let's also talk about something that will be big news in our house because my daughter's a big F1 fan. General Motors are getting into the F1 business.
Yes, that's quite exciting. They've been working with Andretti Motorsport for a couple of years trying to make this happen. And Michael Andretti ruffled a few feathers in the world of motorsport. And he had to step aside, but that's allowed the deal to go through.
Okay. I mean, can you make your mark in F1? Can you muscle in on the action there as a new player, even for such an established company?
Well, it actually has turned out over the years to be even more challenging for established companies. While you have a great deal of financial resources at your disposal, there also is a fair amount of bureaucracy that goes with that. And certainly to succeed in a world like Formula One, you have to be very agile and be able to adapt and move quickly. And that will be, I think, a challenge potentially for the GM Cadillac effort.
Peter, thank you very much. This is World Business Report from the BBC World Service. Cricket fans around the world have been paying close attention to the auction for players in the Indian Premier League. The Indian wicketkeeper Rishabh Pant became the most expensive player in the competition's history after being bought for $3.2 million. A 13-year-old has become the youngest player ever bought. The left-handed batter and spin bowler Vaibhav Suryavanshi went to the Rajasthan Royals for more than $100,000. 13. More and more money then going into the league, and bosses of the 100 cricket tournament in the UK have been hoping to get some Indian investment. Our correspondent Alex Capstick has been finding out more.
I'm at Lord's Cricket Ground in central London, often referred to as the home of cricket. And apart from a few bits of repair work, there's not much going on outside. Inside the offices, though, of the ECB, the governing body of English cricket, that owns the 100, it's very, very different. And I'm here to meet the man in charge of selling it.
I'm Vikram Banerjee. I'm the Director of Business Operations at the ECB and I'm leading on the franchise opportunity for the 100.
Why did you decide that now the time was right to sell part of the 100?
The global landscape of cricket is changing at a rapid rate. There are 17 franchise leagues in the men's game, and so we feel that it's really important that English cricket remains at the top table.
So you've been travelling the world talking to people. There was talk of around about 100 potential investors, is that about right?
We've had over 100 people that have entered our process, having proper conversations around the details. So we're really enthused by that.
It's believed those interested parties include as many as 5 franchises from the all-powerful Indian Premier League. It's one of the richest sports tournaments on the planet. And even though cricket's governing body in India, the BCCI, currently bans its players from joining the 100, Vikram Banerjee is excited about the prospect of team owners getting involved.
Do you think you can ever challenge the IPL? Are they going to remain top of the pile? Can the 100 be close to them?
I think where the IPL is right now, they're so dominant and done such a brilliant job. But we'd love to be just behind them.
Yes, come on.
And English cricket needs Indian money. Many county sides, the domestic side of the game, are struggling financially. Now they stand to share in the proceeds of a sale which it's hoped could raise more than half a billion US dollars. Satish Menon is CEO of the IPL franchise Kings Punjab. They had a close look at the 100 before deciding not to invest.
There were a lot of grey areas, and till the end, we kept thinking of whether it would be worth our while, and we still weren't clear about the gestation periods, how long it'll take for us to, for us to break even and stuff like that. But given the format, considering that it's a new format, and given the fact that it's coming out of UK, which is the nursery of cricket, we have a feeling that in the longer run, the 100 would become a very successful tournament.
And in terms of getting involved in these other tournaments, I mean, already IPL teams are becoming global franchises. Is it the ambition of the teams to have franchises in all parts of the world?
Yes, cricket is growing, undoubtedly, spreading its tentacles across the world. So to that extent, IPL, which is at the top of the pyramid, would definitely look at using its might to be able to spread into markets beyond India.
A report from Alex Capstick. I mean, you've been to one of the 100 matches. They try to make it an evening of entertainment so that you get both two games of cricket and also a band and also other entertainment as well along the way. Now, what are you doing this Friday?
Let's make Black Friday brighter with deals up to 60% off and
weekly Black Friday deals you can't miss.
This Black Friday Deals Week, let the deals come to you.
It is still only Monday in half of the world, but many retailers are already doing their Black Friday deals. Has impulse buying gone a bit too far? Let's talk to Flora, Flora Baganar, who's produced a Netflix documentary called Buy This Now on this very subject. Flora, welcome to World Business Report. Tell us what you found out by making the documentary.
Yeah, so we've been looking at overconsumption and sort of hyperproduction and the sort of oversale of goods, all sorts of things, not just electronics, but fashion, food, everything. And we spoke to a lot of people, but we focused particularly on industry insiders, people who've worked inside these companies, about the kind of selling techniques that they deploy to encourage us and lure us into buying more stuff than we need. And yeah, I mean, it's a frightening picture, but
the whole business of Black Friday, I presume it grew out of the fact that this is the moment where you've basically got the money that you have to spend before Christmas, and then retailers want you to spend it with them. They'll do anything to get hold of that money that you are going to spend over the next month, and is now suddenly just about in your bank account.
Yeah, I mean, it's not just Black Friday. What we really were looking at was every few months, there's another selling, buying opportunity. If it's not Black Friday, it's Christmas, it's Boxing Day, it's, New Year's sales. And so it goes on throughout the year. And really, a lot of these occasions that we think of as celebrations are tied to buying opportunities that we sort of think about because shops are trying to sell us things.
Talk us through some of the techniques you discovered. What are retailers up to in store or online to try and get us to part with our cash?
Well, a lot of Black Friday deals aren't actually great deals. I mean, I think a lot of stuff is released intentionally, they drop the price just before, or they never really drop the price in the first place. But so there's a lot of just general things of sort of tricks of the trade that make us feel like we're getting a deal, but we're not. But also more sort of deeper tricks, it include using our data, using when you buy stuff online, you create a sort of data point that they then gather all this information, work out what sells best, whether it was red text or blue text or whatever that made the most people click on something online. And then that is then used again next year or next selling opportunity to sell more things to more people.
And the data is so interesting because, of course, it enables companies to target us very individually in terms of what we might want, but also the kind of messaging we might respond to.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, the thing about Amazon, which is the biggest shop in the world, is that they also have access to more data than anyone else. So if, they can fine tune it down to the pixel for, you know, these people in this sector who bought this before will probably also want to buy this. So we'll put this on the left-hand side of the page, and they may also want this other thing, so let's put that on the right-hand side of the page. So it's all a way to maximise, you know, the opportunity to get us to part with some money and buy another thing.
Right. Does it matter? I mean, what, I suppose what you're describing is a modern-day version of having chocolate bars near the supermarket checkout. Does it matter? I suppose it might do if you end up spending money you haven't got.
Yeah, I mean, spending money we haven't got, buying things that we don't need, and also, you know, just generally putting more money in the power of a smaller number of companies. You know, the more data one company builds up, the more power it has to sell more things. And that sort of creates a situation where we may just buy all our things from one place, or we may just keep sort of going to the back to the same places to buy stuff, which creates a situation where, yeah, one shop or a number, a small number of companies are much more powerful than others.
And has it changed the way you shop? Now, having made the program and learned about what's going on behind the scenes, has that made any change to what you do?
Oh, definitely. I mean, in a very simple way, I sort of stopped shopping completely for a bit when we were making the film. It took about 2 years to put together. So I feel like we went in waves in the production team. You know, we all stopped shopping, and then we all found ourselves buying things again and feeling guilty.
Flora, I'm going to stop you, but yeah, thank you so much for being with us on World Business Report. I really appreciate it in the run-up to Black Friday. And from me, Andrew Peach, and the whole team here, thank you very much for joining us.